Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we are covering the primary source documents. And if you could qualify them as the primary and the secondary to that level of primary source documents, we're really looking at the secondary primary source documents when we talk about the notes on the convention. Because again, as the content that we have available, because I still haven't been able to find that source where they were capturing all of what they were saying on YouTube, but what we have is very informative. And so bottom line, as we're looking at the Constitutional Convention, they debated the merits as to why to do this or to do that, but they didn't go into all of the details on all things. But when we get into the ratification debates, we're really looking at those items of the Constitution that were really viewed as the most problematic. So in other words, some of the things that we're viewing today, or I should say through the Constitutional Convention, we're going to be a little more focused on those other things that really didn't come up in the debates. Why? Because they're very important. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we really want to focus on, two things that are kind of entwine, are the admission, or is the admission of states into the Union and a Republican form of government. Now, as you've heard me say, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, that threshold of what a Republican form of government was a very loose threshold. In other words, they couldn't create a standard of a Republican form of government that would force the state to change its Republican form of government to a better form. States kind of went there on their own. And so I think that one, we want to garner the what's, why's, how's, and that stuff. But the reason this is important, because we're literally seeing states being torn apart because people have completely lost an understanding of a Republican form of government. And we're literally seeing this focus of a democracy, or at least a minimum democracy. In other words, those people who were willing to get out of their home and to cause harm and create chaos get to rule us. Because really, when you isolate how many people are out in the streets, are we talking about even 1/10 of the population? Not even close. And this goes down to this fundamental tenet of what is representation in America as a Republican form of government and how to define all of that. So I think that there's merit, because there's a few things that actually are kind of piquing people's interest. And so without any further ado, well, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, and actually, I don't want to forget, but the reason why we want to go through this thing called a Republican form of government is the importance of understanding the paradigm of the government that was actually formed. So we've talked about this before, and the average, the world sees a Republican form of government as a government that is representative of the people. Around the world, supposedly, because all nations are republican forms of government. China is a republican form of government. It's representative of the people. The huge difference between China and America are two. First off, the republic is not a constitutional republican form of government. It is a general, in other words, general powers are granted, not limited powers. All states in the world have granted unlimited powers to their government. The only nation that has literally specified you can only do these things is the United States. Huge, huge difference. The other difference between our republican form of government and China is the fact that our republican form of government is not representative of the people. It's not limited to that. As a matter of fact, it goes beyond that into a grander scope of accurately creating a balance in republicanism. And Sean, do you remember what that is?
I would say separation of powers.
Well, there's separations of powers, yeah. No, but what I'm talking about is our legislative bodies don't represent just the people. They represent the sovereigns of our society. In other words, at the federal level, who are the sovereigns of our society?
The states.
And the people. That's why we have a House of Representatives representing the people of the states, and we have a Senate representing the state governments, the state legislatures. And in the state governments, all states have converted themselves into creating a bicameral legislature where you have a House representing the people of the counties. At least, even in Washington State, they did that. In 1889 or whatever that was in their constitution, in one of their constitutions, I don't know about both of them, I just know the one that's current that we're all recognizing, they at least did that. They guaranteed representation to the counties, whether that be half a representation or a whole. Nevertheless, they also created a Senate where representation of the county government was there to ensure this check and balance between the desires of the people and the desires of government for the people. In other words, for the people of the county. So this way, you do have a check and balance to keep government from swinging one way to, you know, becoming everything and feeding and becoming the big teat for the people. Because if it was only the people, that's what would happen. If you had a representative government that only represented the people, it would ultimately become a teat. But if you have one that actually keeps that in check to say, hold on here, we can't afford to give away the milk. We can afford to help, and as a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons why states actually had this relationship with churches, because in the beginning, the churches were the ones that provided the nurturing and the assistance, the compassionate services for the people. They didn't want the government doing that. And that goes into the real shock value that Madison provided in those debates in Congress. You remember?
Yes, sir.
Okay, those being the codfish bounties, right? I mean, he used those as a huge shock value to say, hey, if we can use the justification of money for providing general defense and welfare, for providing the common defense and general welfare of the union, then the next thing we'd know is we'd be basically taking over churches and taking over education. We would be providing everything. And that's exactly what democracies end up doing. The cycle of democracy destroys itself, always, always. So anyway, so as we look and we're kind of talking, there's two things, and Sean, you brought this up before, about what's going on in Minnesota, and it's not the only place that's doing this. As a matter of fact, Antifa has had handbooks. They've had ways of organizing and basically fighting in the streets. But so there's this, I'll call it, this. It's a Bolshevik revolution. It is an organized effort of trying to seize power at the state level. Now we also have, in the mix of this, you know what's going on in Alberta?
No.
So in Alberta, Alberta has been meeting, and I challenge anybody to go look at how, this is it's the dead of winter right now. It's freezing cold out there. And the people of Alberta are so pissed off and they're so upset with the Canadian government. They want independence. They want to be broken away now. Can't happen fast enough. And if you actually go look, you'll actually find that, wow, it's a mass majority of Alberta. A mass. So this speaks to the concept of states being able to be self-admitted, or I should say, states should be able to initiate, external foreign states should be able to initiate initiate the discussion of what is it going to take for us to become a state in the union, because that's Congress's job. So getting back to the Constitutional Convention, some of the things we're going to focus on is we're going to be looking, as we go through this, how these concepts of admitting states into the union, how the concepts of republicanism literally evolved in this Constitutional Convention to where they started understanding with a different paradigm. And so as everybody kind of wrapped up this convention, they all kind of ended up with a common understanding of this new republicanism in America under this Constitution for the federal government, not for states. And the same thing with admitting states into the union. And some of these things, like I said, that may not have come up into the details because they weren't seen by the anti-federalists as deal breakers or, something that they could really use to sink their teeth in to kill the Constitution. So, by all means, because Sean was talking about what's going on in Minnesota, why don't you dive into some of the details of how they're functioning, how they're operating in trying to take that state government, or at least what they're really trying to do is they're trying to fight the constitutional law. They're trying to say, we're going out of our way to defy the Constitution, right?
Absolutely. Okay. And I think a major part of it is this fraud that's been uncovered. And I'm assuming that the people who are involved in this movement are somehow involved with that. I mean, they moved all of these aliens into this area and just completely took over this area. They elected a representative who represents the aliens that were brought in from Somalia. And now all of these lower level politicians and government officials are in charge. They're operating and directing this network to impede federal law enforcement. And I don't even know. I'm not sure what their motivation is. But when you start looking into it deeper, they have foreign investment and foreign financing. There's a person who's a billionaire from China, who's a socialist. Imagine that, a billionaire socialist who's funding this. There's allegations that the lieutenant governor is one of the administrators of their communications channel, where they distribute SOPs, training manuals, describing and instructing people on how to interfere with federal law enforcement. Okay. And it's just insane. And one of the things that was brought up also was that the Department of Justice is trying to get the voter rolls for the states, and certain states are refusing. So you have the voter rolls, and then you have the fraud, defrauding the Medicare system and Social Security and every imaginable government assistance program that you can list. They're defrauding, and they don't want that found out. They're turning it into a racial issue. And now you have the immigration issue as well. So it's all centered around the same thing. And like I said before, It's the same playbook that they use when they go and do regime change in other countries, and now it's being instituted within our own borders.
Yeah, so one, the Constitution doesn't allow this kind of crap. As a matter of fact, when it comes down to executing the laws of the Union, the states are duty-bound to fulfill that. And so we've talked about what should have happened and what needs to happen. And it's not as much of the Insurrection Act that needs to happen, because that right there is problematic. Every public servant. Now, let me back up, because when we understand the magnitude of this movement in Minnesota, it's a small fraction. Now, I don't know. If I had Wikipedia, I'd probably look and say, "How there's this 4 million people in Minnesota." And I can tell you that we're probably looking at maybe 10, 15% of the people of Minnesota, probably less than that. When I say the people, I'm talking about the real U.S. citizens that have a legitimate ability to function in government. Because all of these aliens, all of these Islamists, these Somalis and so forth that have been brought into Minnesota, they can't be granted the citizenship and allowed to have citizenship, because this actually proves how they are defying their oath, because every citizen is legally bound to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic. So to be clear, there's this huge problem, but the majority of the people that are involved in this aren't really citizens. So what is the magnitude of the citizens that are, you know, functioning and active on this? And so can you garner that type of information?
Yeah, they had around 1,000 people on their Signal chat. And I think one of the reasons that they're using the immigrants, and like you said, it's even more upfront with people who are naturalized, correct? Because they're informed that they're required to have this allegiance to the Constitution, whereas someone who was born here, their family's been here forever, they might not know that through their education, that that's a requirement. But when you're naturalized, you go through a process where you are explicitly explained this is your, you know, obligation, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think that they're using these immigrants and these people who are outside, foreign to our country, who haven't assimilated. They put them in a situation where it's impossible for them to assimilate, and they're using them as the pawns. And the idealist leftists who don't know any better, they're being used as pawns, useful idiots for this democratic gangster tactic move to just take over the state. And now that the immigration enforcement is coming in, it's taken away their voters, it's taken away their useful idiots who are running all the scams and kicking back money to them. And that's why they're panicking and resisting, because they come in and take out all the illegal aliens. That's all of their foot soldiers and operators.
Yes. Yeah, so when we really look at the amount of people behind this, we're talking about a very small, small faction of Minnesotans. As a matter of fact, if you look at the last election in Minnesota, the Republicans had gained seats in the House. The Senate didn't move or budge one bit. But I'm expecting this year to see the Senate, the state Senate, not the U.S. Senate, the state Senate in Minnesota to actually swing red. Because there's one seat that is, so there's, it literally is polarized by one seat. There is one seat advantage Republicans in the House, and I expect that to pick up more. And in the state Senate, that's one seat that's advantage to the Democrats. So literally they're kind of at a, you know, a neutrality as far as the legislature goes. I believe that the good people of Minnesota have recognized, and if actually Trump you know, successfully enforces the Constitution. That's all he's got to do. All he's got to do is go in and start removing these people. It will literally alleviate some of these senators and House of Representatives from even being eligible to be reelected. And it'll force new blood and actually people that aren't a part of this cabal that are literally trying to run this rebellion against the Constitution and steal Minnesota away from the Union. It's a matter of enforcement of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It's the supreme law, and there's no doubt that the president has the authority to execute the laws of the union. He has that responsibility of faithfully doing that. And he can basically stand up and say, look, we're going to actually exercise and we're going to enforce Section 3. And we're coming into Minnesota and we're removing everybody that is literally standing up and saying, we can't repel invaders. Because, boy, right here in the Constitution, it's mentioned twice that the Guarantee Clause in Article 4 demands that the United States protects every state from an invasion. And secondly, right there in Article 1, Section 8. And more importantly, the reality is that the previous administrations that had brought in these combatants, from these foreign nations that are Islamic, that are literally enemies of the Constitution. They had no authority to bring them in here, and they had no authority to grant them, just give away citizenship to them. Because that's what happened in lots of cases. They were granting block citizenship. In other words, these people didn't go through the testing and the schooling and everything you really needed to do as an individual immigrant. And there's a lot of immigrants that have actually gone through that are just fit to be tied. I mean, they're just very upset with the fact that they had to go through that process, but the government's allowing this fast tracking to occur. So every single one of those people that are here, that have been born here under the jurisdiction of the foreign states that they've come from, they all need to be packed up and deported. Now, what will happen, and this is a good thing, what will end up happening is you'll find that property in Minnesota will go down dramatically because they've been building accommodations on the federal dollar for all of these types of things. And all of those accommodations, Trump needs to basically say, hey, we don't have any authority to be controlling housing. That's what they're doing in California. That's what they're doing in Washington. They're literally subsidizing all of this, what they call sustainable. And I don't know if you knew this. Are you aware of how in Minnesota, Washington, California, and these really blue states, how they have shifted almost all apartments based on socialism? Are you familiar with that?
Yes, sir.
So what the people may not know is what this means, folks, is when you go to rent, if you want to rent in an apartment because, you know, you're trying to save money at this point to buy a house and you've got income, you're going to be paying more money than the people that are doing nothing, that are literally living off of welfare. In other words, they're practically getting rent for free and you're paying, you know, where it's taking the majority of the money out of your pocket. In other words, there's no longer equal protection under the law. When a person has the right to come in and rent an apartment, they should be able to rent that apartment at the same price as everybody else. But they've now created, oh, well, because you make more than everybody else, we're now going to charge you more based on your income. And that's not supported by equal protection under the law. So as we kind of look at all of these things that they've weaponized and what they're doing in Minnesota, as well as all these other states, It's Washington, too.
Corridors.
I mean, I can't forget this was going on in Oregon, right?
Yes, sir.
They were on their protest in Oregon.
That's what I was saying. I think this is Minnesota is ground zero for their next moves.
Well, I can't to argue that it obviously is.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review, as well as my description of the Republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so apologize. I ended up having to kind of go a little independent and had to dial in with the phone so I could take care of Murphy. If not, I was going to have a bark attack, and I didn't realize that we were in the midst of a commercial. So my sincere apologies. But that all being said, I believe that when we really look at some of the bastions that are incredibly strongholds right now, these states within a state, we look at Dearborn, Michigan, and I think that's probably, I don't know if there's any place that has a greater stronghold. You aware of anything, Sean, that's greater than that?
Not at the moment. I know there are some places in Texas that are getting pretty big.
Yes.
You just shut down one of them, but I heard about Florida the other day.
Right. And it's not a surprise what they're doing. But they're creating these hardcore distractions to where they've got a launching point for a revolution. An unconstitutional revolution. I mean, as long as we're following and executing the laws of the Union, we can clean this up really quick. We can clean this up really quick. Because currently, the states demand, all of the states are demanding the Constitution is still the supreme law of the land. Now, the question is, will the capitulation of the currency happen under Trump's watch where he says, we need to put that aside? Because here's my fear in all of this, is if this happens under his watch and says, but you can trust my administration, we're not going to do bad things with this power that we're taking away from you. That's the real concern, is who comes next, and then who comes next, and the attacks and the whacks that will end up happening. Because once the Constitution's gone, folks, it's gone. And the states are the parties to it, and if the parties allow that to happen, then we've got a real problem. This is why, because we were talking about this earlier in a different conversation. We were talking about counties and the counties' role in the states. If the counties have not surrendered their role in the state by allowing themselves to become a participant in a charter with the states for home rule or all this other stupid crap, then the counties actually can stand up and take their state back. Just like the states can stand up and take their constitution back. Take the union back. So the real question is, where are we going to go with this? Because right now we're looking, and the problem is that as we look at things, we typically see things from our perspective, and I'm telling you, folks, we're all at the same point. We're all along the banks of the river, watching the byproduct of the crap upstream floating by. There's stuff that's happening upstream that is going to end up floating by in the near future. The education system is a huge driver of that. You have no idea what kind of kids are going to be coming out of the education system. I think we got an idea, I should say. And that's a reality. That's going to be refuge that is going to be floating by. The problem that we've always had, as the way people think, is they want to fix the problem in the river right here by the banks. Nobody wants to go upstream and figure out what the sources are that are putting this crap in the water. And that's what we have to do. We have to actually stop what is doing this upstream. Education system is one of those big things. The social engineering by the federal government and allowing the federal government to have these types of controls that are not constitutional, but like the importation of persons, that they've got to undo every non-citizen, or I should say a person that is literally a combatant against the United States Constitution. If they are Islamic, a Mohammedan, or whatever you want to call them, then they cannot support and defend the U.S. Constitution. They're literally lying, and they're going to continue to lie and deceive us while they're demanding the Sharia law and the infliction of Islam upon us. And that doesn't fly here. Can't fly here. Got to go. And we've got to let it. Right now, they think that they have an upper hand. And I'm here to tell you, folks, they may have an upper hand because of the lunacy of people in the United States. Maybe we need to start stripping citizenship away from people that want to support these types of things until they come to their senses. One of the things that has actually propagated this is this concept of secret ballot voting when it comes to our government. How did they vote in 1789 when the good people were voting for their representatives? How did they vote? Did they have secret ballots?
It would probably be pretty hard to have a secret ballot in those times anyway.
Right. And right, to have the resources of just printing ballots where they may put names on a piece of paper, but 9 times out of 10, it was easier for the sheriff, because what happened was you collected, everybody was at the seat of government the day of the election. They all descended upon it, and the election was during a certain hour period of the day. So if you didn't get there, you didn't get to vote. You had to be there at that point in time of the election. And the sheriff would literally go around, either by name or however the sheriff decided to execute that election, if he wasn't given direction by the state legislature. And he would execute the names on the ballot, making sure that those names were legitimate names. They were residents. They were blah. You know, they were citizens. They were the ones that were, you know, the truth detectors, because the state legislature, they couldn't manage all of that. It was all done at a local area. And so they asked, okay, how do you vote? Who do you vote for your representative? Who do you vote for your sheriff? Who do you vote? And went down the line and wrote it all down, and then went to the next person, wrote it all down, wrote it to the next person, wrote it all down. That way they kept a tally. And the sheriff then counted everything out. This person won this. This person won this. Blah, blah, blah. It was all, most of the time it was via voca, is what they called it back then, by voice. This concept that you have a right to be able to vote for in secret so you can prove, because let's just say this, going backwards and speaking in sentence fragments, I hate doing that, but let's look at a candidate that openly claimed that they would do things that would be a violation of the Constitution. They should have been removed from the ballot. But let's just say you still voted for that person, even though they were removed from the ballot. They get elected because they were added, right? Or for whatever reason. Or let's just say that there was comments that you could prove down the road that everybody knew this guy, like Obama, was going to outright violate the Constitution. Everybody that voted for him knew that, but it wasn't public knowledge. And therefore, the people that voted for him to get those outcomes, they should actually have their citizenship stripped. Because they literally voted for somebody that was going to deliberately violate the Constitution. How is a citizen voting for that eligible to maintain their citizenship? It's not a crime where you're going to go to jail, but you shouldn't be able to be a citizen if you're not going to support the Constitution. Does that make sense? And I know this is really thin ice I'm on, but these are paradigms that are so precious that if we can't get our arms around this and understand why, and I'll even go out on some really thin ice in a different direction. We have these people that are called sovereign state, national sovereign citizens. They're out deliberately convincing people to surrender, to basically give up their citizenship so they can't vote. Good people. Instead of actually supporting the Constitution and trying to defend it against enemies, foreign and domestic, they're telling people to just surrender and run away. That right there, to me, is somebody that actually should be deported, because that right there is a revolution against the Constitution as well. Now, whether anybody agrees with me on this or not, that's neither here nor there. The bottom line is our obligation is to support, not to capitulate, to run away from. Our obligation is to support. Prove me wrong. And so, Sean's just the guy to do that. I mean, he's going to go and find some things out there, and he's probably going to create a great challenge for me. But
not on that point, sir.
I am looking at this as a black and white issue. This is literally that clear that either you are on board with supporting the rule of law and the supreme law being the Constitution, or you are on board with tyranny and revolution and basically revolting and getting rid of the Constitution and implementing a completely different government outside those functions and processes that are within the Constitution. There is a way. There's a way to change our government, and it's called the Article 5 Amendment process. If you're not doing it that way, then you are way off course, and you are violating, and you stand in jeopardy of being deported. And as far as I'm concerned, the people that are literally active in convincing citizens to do the wrong thing, either to support their revolution against the Constitution or to run away from it, folks, they ought to be deported today. All of these people ought to be deported today. If you're part of the Chinese Communist Party, deported. Part of these people that are citizens that are doing their bidding and getting and enlisting other people to do this, the teachers' union, deported. Get these people out of the United States. This goes to the biblical understanding that we are not obligated. As a matter of fact, we are required to remove the enemy from our home, which is why the Tory Acts were executed the way they were. They were done very quickly, swiftly, with extreme prejudice. You supported Britain, you're out. That's what we need to do. To me, it's that simple. Has this gone?
Go ahead. I heard a term on a report yesterday that pretty much described it when you really think about it. We've gotten to a point in our culture where we have this suicidal empathy, to where we care so much about not looking like a bad person and not hurting people's feelings and giving everybody a chance, you know, and giving them the benefit of the doubt. And now we have 20 million unvetted people in our country, and I would say at least a good percentage of them came here with the intent of doing harm to our republic and our nation. If not directly of their intent, but that was the reason that they came here.
Yeah.
So, or were brought here. You know, and like you were saying, I mean, trying to spread liberty throughout the world is one thing, because we want all of God's children to live under a system where they can have the autonomy and the sovereignty to worship God in the proper way. At the same time, you don't just let thieves and demoniacs into your camp and thinking you're going to convert them. Right. Because they're just going to slit your throat while you're sleeping.
Right.
Well, you know, it's the bottom line.
Yes. Yeah, so I looked at this a long, 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 long time ago in a completely different perspective when we started socializing medicine, because it aligned with my perspective on citizenship. And what you said about these people having empathy for suicide, or these people that are literally committing national suicide, and having empathy for them. Those people that have empathy for the enemy are enablers. When we look at our healthcare system, could be so good. But bottom line is, we require insurance companies, and actually the way insurance companies are working, they're killing us. And they are doing it at a rate of making insane profits. Putting all that aside, a long time ago, before Obamacare, there were requirements that started being forced from the government by regulating that these people that didn't have health care insurance still deserve to be treated. And the laws were already being put in place before Obamacare that you had to treat these people. And back in those days, it really wasn't that bad, because they were few and they weren't destructive people. But what ended up happening, this opened the door, because I want to say these policies kind of came down from the original socialized medical care administration, the Clinton administration, with Hillary Care. And the concept was, and at least they started creating federal regulations, I believe you'll find it happening in the 90s, where they started leaning on hospitals and providers to make sure that they provide care for everybody, that they couldn't deny people. And so they had lawyers out there going after people that, you know, they would probably tag up with these, you know, I'll just call them, you know, degenerates or what have you, that were living on the streets, and say, hey, you know, I when you need help, you just call me and I'll make sure that we sue the hospital that doesn't take care of you under these new federal laws. And it was the same thing with the ADA. When the ADA was invoked in the 90s, again, I believe that was a part of the Clinton administration, there was a league of lawyers out there running around shutting down ma-and-pa businesses because they were non-compliant to the ADA, American Disabilities Act. Anyway, so as we look at what was happening, everybody started getting scared and saying, okay, we're going to do this. Now that was virtue signaling to people to say, hey, it doesn't matter how high you get and how often you get high anymore. There's no point in controlling yourself, you know, for trying to survive. Just burn yourself out. Because if you get sick, they'll have to take care of you. And I know this because shortly after Obamacare, it was getting really bad, where the hospitals began being overran by all of these, I'll say, drug users that would literally come in, you know, be brought back from the brink of death, and then expect to have their clothes washed for them and pressed. I mean, literally, these patients in the hospital had, you know, no compunction. I just, hey, can you take these down to the cleaners and get my clothes clean? I mean, they thought it was, you know, a full service hotel. And then when they walked out, they would instantly find themselves getting high in the gutter and back in there. I believe that we need to start creating laws that stop enabling. As a society, we cannot enable bad behavior. we should be indicted for allowing this type of destructive behavior to be acceptable. It's one thing for a person to want help. Everybody wants help for their owie nowie, but nobody wants to actually change their behavior. But if you can no longer get, you know, help for your owie nowie, then you absolutely have to start changing your behavior. And the only way you can get that help by putting compassionate services back where they belong. That would be with the religious and community institutions that hold you to a higher standard. Say, look, we're not, you know, we're not here to take money from people just so you can have a good time. If you want to help yourself, you've got to stop drinking. If you get drunk, we're not helping you. Because that's what your problem is. You get high on drugs, we're not helping. By putting our foot down and forcing people to become productive members of society, because the education system is not. They were actually virtue signaling the kids in school that, hey, doesn't matter what you do, just go have a good time because we're going to take care of you either way. And everybody started gaming the system. This is why we have such out of control homelessness. And this is why we literally have, well, there's a word for it, a viral. This is why we have viral humans now, right? That's the right term, right? Somebody that is
not sure.
Viral, it's feral. I think it's feral yeah. with an F.
Like a cat.
Yeah, like a feral cat. We have feral humans right. now.
And I agree with you in that mode. And I think that the church could do a lot more. But we know that how that has evolved and that the situation is so out of control with that it's ridiculous. At the same time, you have that culture, that openness and freedom in our culture is being used against us by the reverse opium wars that we got going on with fentanyl. But what I wanted to say was that's one thing, and you have a certain segment of society. And I agree with you to a certain extent on personal responsibility when it comes to those things. That's the bottom line. If you're abusing drugs or alcohol, you know, we don't look down or denigrate you because you have a problem for whatever reason. But you have to take personal responsibility. You can't expect somebody to come along and get you to stop drinking. You have to do it on your own. But what about the other side with the healthcare issues, where you have like the opium epidemic with OxyContin that was perpetrated by a multi-billion-dollar international corporation that gets a slap on the wrist, and then the next thing they've got another government contract paying them billions of dollars. And then you have the GLP-1 thing where we have, you know, the fat drug where everybody's now hooked on this drug that costs them $1,000 a month for the rest of their life.
Right.
And we all know that started way back during the times of the robber barons when Rockefeller and Carnegie got together and pretty much just took over the pharmaceutical industry and created this whole thing that's been poisoning us. I mean, when you look at the MAHA agenda and the facts and evidence that's there from these companies that have been able to poison the population at large for the last 100 years, you know, and you can't hold people accountable from 100 years ago, but what do we need to do to cut that off to where that doesn't continue and happen again? And we have all these bureaucracies that are built in that are supposed to regulate it and provide safety for the American people, but they're actually just licensing and providing cover for the companies that are actually hurting people. You got over 50% of children in the country are pre-diabetes.
Okay, so but
which means they're going to have multiple lifelong medical problems because they were allowed to be poisoned because of the regulatory agencies are captured.
Right. So in the interest of time, because everything you're talking about are systemic problems coming from corporate cultures, evil corporate cultures, right? Because when you're pointing the ugly stick and hitting these culprits, these aren't just an individual doing something. You know, and because what we, right. what I was doing was I was using the ugly stick on those that were basically living with bad behavior and those in society that were enabling that bad behavior. Now let's let's look at, now let's shift. Let's look at if we were following the Constitution, would we be able to have corporations that would actually function with pure immunity across state boundaries? Not under our Constitution. The federal government can't regulate corporations. In other words, every state in the union would literally have the ability, if Pfizer was going to function and sell their products across the union and to, you know, to deliver these types of things, every state would be able to start creating these barriers or regulations to say, look, we're not allowing that to happen here. Because that may benefit the one state like California where all of this stuff may start, but all the rest of the states would basically shut the doors down and say, that's not coming here. In other words, it's one thing to, you know, have the ability to initiate an evil program like what we see the pharmaceutical companies doing, or what we see with the railroad companies and what they did. The only reason these companies were so successful in stealing our wealth and so successful in doing us harm is because the federal government ran interference for them. So you take that out of it and get the federal government, who has no authority to be involved in any state commerce. They're to regulate commerce among the states. They're the traffic cop to make sure that the states aren't creating warfare against each other. And so with that, you know, we can actually look at, you know, what would life be like if we were abiding by the Constitution? And how could we actually undo some of these things that they have done to us? Or would he, you know, first off, would we be in these same situations? And how could we avoid those other situations that may be descended upon us? Because I think by now we would have been able to respond to these types of things, especially the states where the people, where there's good people governing themselves. So, and this is the amazing thing, because when you really look at it, we have some states that are very, very progressive. But when you add it all up, there's not 14 states that are that progressive. In other words, to basically pass an amendment that would be for the good, we could probably easily start creating amendments to start stopping, you know, some of this corporate raiding, or I should say this warfare, social engineering, these types of things. We could literally pass that amendment, because when we look at the progressive states, I don't think that those progressive states, the state legislatures, would actually not ratify these good amendments. But when it comes to taking away our rights, they have to have 38 states. They need 38 states to make an amendment to actually take away liberties, like take away our Second Amendment rights. And I don't see that ever happening. And I think that by the construction, the design of the Constitution, we're truly protected by that. Anyway, I'm really glad we had this derailing or this side topic, because we need to get back to Alberta, though. But anyway, with that, folks, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.